You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Manny. E whai akane, come up on the show today. For a weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about Labour's new capital gains tax, slashing of funding for the Māori news organisations, the Hui and Te Karere, and the party's campaigning plans 1 year away from the next general election. And I spoke with Lisa Durra, a senior curriculum and pedagogy researcher at the University of Auckland, about the government's new maths curriculum of 4 years 0 to 10. Manny, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with James Russell, Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, and Peter Morton, Coordinator of the Department of Conservation's Predator Control Program, about an impending explosion of predator populations.
Hey, aho whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e a hei ana koutou. Te whakaronga ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai. Tuku tuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM, irikati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Recently, the Labour Party has unveiled their capital gains tax, or CGT, policy. The policy only targets properties with the exception of family homes and farms. The tax policy, according to Labour, will supply all New Zealanders with 3 free doctor visits yearly. For a weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, I spoke to him about Labour's CGT policy and what the Greens think of it. We also discussed the funding cuts for the Māori news organisations Te Karere and The Hui, as well as how the Green Party will be campaigning 1 year out from the next general election. But first, we discuss Labour's CGT policy. What does the Green Party think about Labour's CGT policy?
Lines have been drawn ahead of the election, and if the voters want a government that actually represents change and is bold enough to tax the wealthy few, the Green Party is the only party with a fully costed wealth tax to ensure that we can not just fund 3 GP visits, but bring our GPs into the public healthcare system, introduce things like free dental, as well as build enough public housing to end issues like homelessness. We do think it's disappointing that the Labour Party has gone with an announcement that will simply not deliver enough change for people who desperately need cost of living relief and addresses huge growing wealth inequality in our country where the rich are getting richer while the rest of the people are struggling to make ends meet.
If we're looking at the government's thoughts on this, Finance Minister Nicola Willis says Labour's policy is a terrible idea that would offload the costs onto businesses and would act as a handbrake on the economy. Is this a statement you would agree with?
Absolutely not. It's borderline hysterical to be calling a very narrow capital gains tax such things. And this is the problem, though, is that we've got a Labour Party that is offering very few bold solutions to an inequality crisis that we're facing, and then a National Party that at any attempts, no matter how small, to tax property investors who are making huge profits at a time of an inequality crisis cries out as if we're about to introduce fully automated communism. I think what we need is a mature conversation on the reality that we've got a handful of families who own a huge proportion of our wealth, and that many people are locked out of even having stable rentals, let alone home ownership, because of high house prices and because of the reality that we don't tax wealth.
Will this policy stop rising house prices, or even the amount, of properties available on the market? Will it improve the amount of properties available on the market?
Probably only marginally, and because of how narrow it is, it probably won't have as much of an effect as critics are claiming it will do. In order to bring house prices down, what we need to do is not just introduce a wealth tax, which the Green Party is campaigning on, but actually build enough public housing, which has shown to actually help stabilize and even lower house prices across communities, as well as providing stable housing for people that are currently homeless.
And you have touched on this both with that question there and the first question I asked, but rather than Labour's CGT policy, what would the Green Party like to see in this area?
If the voters want a government that actually represents change as opposed to just tinkering around the edges, the Green Party is the only option, as we are campaigning for a wealth tax to ensure that the wealthy few pay their fair share. The difference with a capital gains tax is that it will bring far more revenue, which will allow us to better fund our public services, and it will also better tackle huge amounts of wealth that are being hoarded by a small handful of families. And we've made sure that our policy doesn't disadvantage, for example, pensioners who may be what we call capital rich but cash poor. And we're going to make sure that we're targeting actual people who have quite high levels of wealth and yet are paying less tax than, say, for example, an everyday worker.
On to our second topic. We have seen major funding cuts to the Māori news organisations Te Karere and The Hui by Te Māngai Pāho. Why are we seeing these cuts in funding to these Māori news organisations?
It seems like the government does not value Māori media. And Te Karere and The Hui have been critical and telling stories on issues that affect Māori, as well as holding governments to account. Before being an MP, I had the pleasure of working with The Hui on stories around beneficiaries and homelessness, and I could see that outlets like The Hui are critical in order to tell stories from the ground up, and I'm really disappointed to see this government continuing its attack on Māori media and Māori communities and undermining actually a journalistic outlet that holds governments of all stripes to account. That can only end up undermining our democracy.
Does the Green Party then believe that this government, by slashing funding to these organisations, it's their attempt to silence critical voices of this government? Is that what you're saying?
Te Karere and The Hui are critical to holding not just this government, but any government to account, and to specifically tell stories on issues that disproportionately affect Māori. And when we've got a government that is undermining Te Tiriti left, right and centre, and at the same time not delivering adequate funding to Māori media, one can only draw the conclusion that this government simply does not want journalistic outlets that are going to be critical of them. And Māori media is not just critical at holding government to account, but has played a key role in the revitalisation of Te Reo Māori as well. And this is why it's really disappointing to see these funding cuts and why we are committed to adequately fund Māori media so that journalists across regions can collaborate.
If we're talking about Māori media as a whole, what are the importance of these programs, The Hui and Te Karere, especially compared to other forms of Māori news that are available, that are out there, such as Te Ao Māori News, Wātia News and E Tangata? What differentiates The Hui and Te Karere from these different forms of Māori news?
Well, we need a thriving and diverse Māori media sector. And so I think, you know, any moment in which we are seeing that sector narrowing is problematic, because we would be saying the same thing if we suddenly saw a narrowing of, I guess, Pākehā media outlets as well. But I think for shows like The Hui, for example, they're long-form pieces that, A, allow, for example, political debate to happen. They also tend to tell longer-form stories so they can go deeper on issues. For example, I remember being interviewed earlier this year on an issue relating to seasonal workers, predominantly Māori, and the challenges that they face when they're in and out of season, and the poverty that comes out of that as a result. And those are unique stories that those outlets are able to tell because of the format in which they are presented. And so when we lose those outlets, we also lose the ability to tell longer form format stories, which in and of itself affects the kind of voices that we see represented in media, particularly Māori voices.
How would the Green Party ensure these organisations thrive?
Well, adequate funding is one thing, and then making sure that we embed better collaboration across the region so that people can work to tell stories in our rural centres as well, which are also really important in terms of making sure that we have a thriving and diverse media sector in our country. The reality is that some media outlets will require crowdfunding, and that if we value public media, we can't just leave journalism to the market, and we need to ensure that we're adequately resourcing the fourth estate so that it can hold government to account, as well as tell a diverse range of stories from across the country.
Finally, we are roughly 1 year out from the next general election. How has your experience been as a member of the opposition with this government?
It's been really relentless being an opposition MP in a government that is actively increasing material hardship for children, that is actively attacking our natural environment, driving the cost of living up, and literally relying on increasing unemployment to deal with inflation. And so I'm really looking forward to the election to change this government, but not just to change who's in charge, but to change the kind of politics that we have in our country and make sure that we tackle the big issues of today, as opposed to just keep on being distracted with culture wars that are being imported from overseas.
What has the Green Party done as an opposition party that would solidify voter confidence heading into the polls?
Yeah, well, I'll speak for myself, and I'm really proud of the fact that in my role as an MP that I have been able to, for example, stop multiple deportations, work to address issues around exploitation, bring to light how the new benefit sanctions will be affecting disabled people. And this has allowed me to work with a range of communities that perhaps the Greens haven't always represented. And I know many of my colleagues are doing the exact same thing. And we've also been putting solutions to the table on what a different kind of government could be. This is why we didn't do what other opposition parties have done, which is to wait to the last minute to start announcing policies and to give voters confidence that we're really serious about changing policies that will allow us to fund free dental, free GPs, bring those things into the public healthcare system and to tax the wealthy few fairly so that people can lead good lives.
And how are the Green Party planning on campaigning over the next year?
Well, unlike the big parties, we don't rely on big money to campaign, and we instead rely on people power. So if people want to see not just a change of government, but a change of politics, my message is to get involved, to help us canvass, to talk to people one-on-one. And we've seen not just in our previous Greens campaigns that those tactics have led to record results, but in campaigns overseas like Sohrab Mamdani's campaign that he's done, which has relied predominantly on people having conversations on the ground. So we look forward to doing exactly that next year to increase our share of the vote and have a stronger hand in the next government.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez march on a Labour's capital gains tax policy, the funding cuts for Te Karere and the Hui, and how the party will be campaigning roughly 1 year out from the next general election.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez march.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Christoph Altruinto is playing The Other's Way, Saturday, November 29, presented by 95BFM.
The song is Month of Sundays by Echomatica. And before that was Traffic Jam by Christoph El Truento. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know any of your thoughts on these pieces today. You can text in on 53955 or give us a call on 309-3879.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
The Ministry of Education has recently revealed their new draft maths curriculum for years 0 to 10, making this new curriculum the third in 3 years. In announcing the move, Education Minister Erica Stanford says the new curriculum is another step forward for the country producing a world-leading system for all students. However, the new curriculum has faced criticism, such as around the amount of time educators are expected to have implemented the new curriculum. As a result, multiple open letters have been sent to the government. In an open letter from 44 maths education experts yesterday, they say the changes seem more political than educational. I spoke to Lisa Durra, a senior curriculum and pedagogy researcher at the University of Auckland, about this new curriculum and what her thoughts are on it. As a broad question, what is this new curriculum and how is it different from prior curriculums we've seen in the past few years?
So, first of all, we had a curriculum that was developed throughout 2022 and then that was sort of sent into schools in 2023. It was just there for kind of getting used to consultation for teachers just to sort of have a lead in time, be aware of it. Then we got a new government, and they rewrote that curriculum and then released it in 2024 and asked teachers to start immediately using it at the beginning of this year, 2025. So that curriculum was the one that became officially mandated and the legally required curriculum for teachers to use. And I'm sure that teachers did not expect it to change. This was the final curriculum. We don't typically have new curriculum regularly. The previous curriculum that was mandated was in 2007. So it was a huge shock when a week ago suddenly there was another new curriculum, and it was substantially different from the one that the teachers have been using all year. The structure of it's different, there's content that's shifted around, and there's content that's been removed as well. So it's quite different.
You've touched on it there, but we've seen lots of changes to the maths curriculum over the past 3 years. Why have we seen so many of these changes?
Well, in the first place, we were well overdue for a new curriculum. I mean, 2007 was quite a long time ago. And, you know, you do need to regularly update the curriculum to reflect current knowledge and pedagogies. And we're trying to make a difference in mathematics education in this country. And by creating a new curriculum, you can help facilitate that change. It's not a silver bullet. It's not going to do everything all on its own. But the first curriculum rewrite made a significant change in being much more detailed and specifying what should be taught at each year level. And what was happening before is some children weren't getting the opportunity to learn the content at their age level. They were sort of learning content at their attainment level, which was lower. And that was kind of leading to growing gaps in between sort of those who were achieving at their level and those below. That sort of that gap would get wider and wider. So the new curriculum kind of said, you must teach, you know, each child, to give them the opportunity to learn material at their level. So that's what that curriculum did. But what we actually need is the chance to embed the curriculum and the chance for teachers to get used to the new curriculum and develop their programs around that new curriculum. And it does take quite a bit of time before you really see any difference being made.
The government claims this new curriculum is only an update. From what you are understanding about this most recent announcement, is this claim accurate?
It's not accurate at all. No mathematics education or statistics education researcher thinks of it as an update. No teacher thinks of it as an update. It is so different from the last one. The structure of it is different. There's different in the content. And there's really important aspects that have been removed. Since that, the thing that really caught my attention at first was the fact they've taken out the statistical inquiry cycle. And this is a way of teaching statistics that New Zealand is kind of renowned worldwide for. We're very good at statistics education. We're often copied by other countries in the world. They follow our curriculum, and then here we are taking what's really good about our statistics education out of the curriculum all of a sudden for no good reason.
This update, as the government calls it, has, adding on to your point just there, has 86 objectives in a student's first year of education compared to 30 from last year's version. And on top of that, students are expecting to learn more maths procedures and vocabulary each year of schooling. Are these expectations, for example, achievable, or are we putting too much on a student's plate and on schools and teachers?
Well, we're certainly putting a huge amount on the plate of teachers, because it's complete rewrite is something new that they have to learn, and they don't have much time to learn before they implement it. In terms of how students will cope with this, it will be interesting to see how they manage. What I suspect will happen is that in order for students to be able to memorise all the sort of list of content and procedures that this new curriculum has, it means they'll lose out on other really important aspects that we used to have in our curriculum. So there will be absolutely no time left to do any kind of problem solving or any kind of creative activities or realistic tasks or any kind of the rich tasks that we used to incorporate alongside the explicit teaching in a program. So all of that would probably end up being stripped out. And so our students won't get a rich mathematics learning experience. They'll just have to memorize things.
You mentioned teachers don't have a lot of time to implement this new curriculum. To my knowledge, it is roughly 8 weeks that teachers are expected to implement this for term one next year. Are teachers and schools getting support or enough support from the government to implement this new curriculum?
Well, the irony is that they did get a whole lot of support this year. Well, when I say a lot, they got a couple of teacher-only days to help learn about the curriculum that they were teaching this year. And you know, those teacher-only days, students had to stay home and parents had to look after the children in whatever way they could. And that's just a complete waste now, because everything they learned on those days is obsolete. In terms of will they get enough, I don't know what the ministry has planned in order to support teachers in this. Typically, around the world and in the past in our country, you would have a year of getting used to a new curriculum before you're made to teach it. So you've got all of that time. You know, you can spend the school holidays, and you can spend staff meetings after school, and you can have all of these time slowly getting used to a new curriculum rather than having to get used to it as you're teaching it.
Has there been enough time to digest the effectiveness or even what needs to change about the prior curriculums to ensure these new changes are necessary?
Absolutely not. So the first curriculum didn't even get a chance to be taught. The second curriculum that we're currently having is only 9 months old in schooling, and there is no evidence that has yet been collected to show whether that has made a difference. And we wouldn't really expect to see much. I mean, I would expect it to take a few years before you would see anything. You've got to remember that for primary school teachers, they were all given the new curriculum to implement at the same time. So if you're teaching year 7 or 8 at intermediate school, you're teaching students a new curriculum that's more difficult, but they haven't had 6 years of that more difficult curriculum leading up. So you've sort of got suddenly the students in front of you have to be taught a more sophisticated content without having had the lead up to that content. So it's very challenging for the intermediate teachers, and they were facing that with this curriculum, but the new one that's just been dropped is even more difficult again for that age group. So they're going to face that challenge again, and certainly we will not see improvements immediately. It's impossible.
In Budget 2025, the Minister for Education, Eric Stanford, unveiled an investment of almost $100 million into improving maths achievements for students between years 0 and 8. Will this new curriculum be effective in improving statistics, in your opinion?
I think we need to look at that expenditure really closely, because often when the government announce an expenditure, they're not actually taking into consideration the money that's been taken out of other areas. So there's been a lot of things that were previously funded in education that have lost their funding. So I would want to know whether these millions of dollars actually take into consideration the millions of dollars that weren't spent. I also would want to know how much of that money was spent offshore, you know, and went into the pockets of overseas agencies that perhaps created the textbooks that have been given to schools, or if we find out that it was indeed an overseas private consultancy that wrote this most recent curriculum, which we all suspect it was, although we don't have the names anywhere officially as to who wrote this curriculum. I would want to question all of that expenditure first, and then you might look at the statistics second. But at the moment, there is no data that shows how the students might be achieving based on any changes.
That was the University of Auckland's Lisa Darra on the government's new maths curriculum for years 0 to 10.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Kate Bollinger is gracing New Zealand's shores with her captivating tunes this January, and 95BFM has tickets to give away, for B card holders that is, so tune in to Breakfast next week for your cue to enter. Kate Bollinger, live at Double Whammy, January 9th. Tickets from the slackagency.co.nz or under the radar.
He finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no, what if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God, it's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday, only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
I'm optimistic as a team. Now it's terror. Airplanes crash into town. If Daymo says the enemy's among us, taking our women and taking our jobs, a reasonable fool is being Drenna. By the non-stop bang, bang, bang the gun. So I go hunting for witches. I go hunting for witches. Heads are going to roll. I go hunting for witches.
Things end.
everything and make me see. You know that I would give you anything. I'd take away your pain, yeah, I'd take away the sting.
That was I Try to Talk to You by Hercules and Love Affairs, and before that, Hunting for Witches by Block Party. Welcome back to The Wire.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
Every few years, Aotearoa's beech trees produce a great quantity of mast, or fruit, that feeds many of our native birds, but also our pests. This coming year, conservation experts are gearing up to suppress what they expect will be an explosion of predator species in a mega mast. And once the beech fruit is gone, they'll turn their eyes onto our protected species. I began our look into this issue by talking to Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, James Russell.
So, to start us off, the mega beech mast that's coming up, could you give our listeners a bit of an overview of what it is, really?
Mast seeding is a really interesting reproductive strategy that a number of plant species, some of which we have in New Zealand, use. In New Zealand, we have beech forest and tussock grassland, and what they choose as a reproductive strategy is rather than just predictably going every year where the predators can key in on it and know that it's going to come, they kind of wait what seems like randomly, and then just once every couple of years, they just drop all their seed at once in huge numbers. And so the things that would usually eat that seed and stop it turning into plants is unable to respond to that in time. So it's a really good evolutionary strategy, and scientists have recently discovered that what generates that is it's actually the temperature differential. So it's not actually random. The plants sort of have an internal body clock that says, oh, there's been a big change in temperature from last year, so I'll use that as my motivating cue to drop all my seed next year. And so the challenge with this is when all of this seed drops, it creates this trophic fountain which explodes up the food chain, and then all the animals respond to it, some of them being the animals we want to get lots of food, but some of them being ones that we don't want to feed up, such as the introduced predators.
So we get a huge explosion in population from both native species and these predators. In the long run, what sort of impacts does this have for our conservation efforts?
So before humans arrived in New Zealand, this was a really good strategy which New Zealand birds and other animals evolved towards. So they knew that if they just bided their time and waited until these mast seeding events happened, they could have bumper years. So species, particularly parrots and parakeets, such as kakapo, kaka and kakariki, they would wait. And when all that seed comes, they would explode in numbers and have a really great reproductive year that would see them through for many years to come. The challenge is when introduced predators arrived, they also benefited from this, and they realized that they'd stay at really low numbers, but when these big seeding events happened, there'd be all this food. So rats and then stoats would explode in numbers in response to this. So for a while, that's okay, as the rats and the stoats are just competing with the other native birds for these seeds. But then what happens is the seed stops because the mast seeding is completed for the year, and then all of those introduced predators turn around and go, oh, well, we're really hungry still, and there's lots of us. How about all you birds that have just had lots of babies? We're going to come eat all of you now. And so that's that huge problem where we see that negative repercussion, where the mast seeding event, which would usually have been good news for our bird species and still is in the kakapo program, for example, turns into bad news a few months later when the swarm of predators turns on them.
So is this quite a significant part of the conservation headspace? If you're thinking about protecting birds or protecting taonga species, that this is a core moment?
Over the last 20 years, we've really realised it's pretty critical in terms of preserving our bird species that we have an awareness of this. There's generally two types of forest across New Zealand. We get what's called podocarp and or broadleaf forest, and that's what dominates in the North Island. And it's when you go down to the South Island that you see a lot more of this beech forest, which is where the mast seeding happens. The podocarp broadleaf forest tends to follow a more normal, regular pattern of just seeding and fruiting once a year, although they too can have good and bad years to create a bit of unpredictability. But it's really down in the South Island that this beech forest has these major mast seeding events. And in this case, it's not even just the whole of the South Island will do it this year. It really comes down to microhabitat and that temperature differential. So DOC now have the models to forecast where these mast seeding events are going to be strongest. And for this one coming up this summer, they know that that mast seeding is going to be happening basically from the top of the western, northwestern South Island all the way to the bottom in Fiordland. Mast seeding is a really interesting experiment in ecology, we learn a lot about natural systems. So it's been really great that we've been able to do what's called fundamental science and just understand what's the ecophysiology that motivates these plants to seed. It used to seem random to us, but now we understand it's this temperature differential. And then it's a great example of how someone working on fundamental science was able to translate that and work with applied scientists who were saying, this is really a problem that we have these explosions of pests following these mass seeding events. How can we use that fundamental science to help us better predict our monitoring and when we have to do this implementation? So it's really been quite good that we've been able to now translate that science over just 10 or 20 years into really applied management to stop these extinction events. In 1999, in the top of the South Island, they lost the last population of mohua or yellowhead because we just didn't know how to predict these events or how to respond to them appropriately.
Right. And with our growing ability to predict them, are we seeing any connection to things like climate change, or is it more of a relative year-to-year thing?
The role of climate change in this is really interesting because it's a temperature differential effect, climate change shouldn't make it more or less common. Although the hot years will get hotter, the cold years will also get hotter. So it's still about that difference between the hottest hot year and the hottest cold year. So we shouldn't see a greater change in mass seeding events from it. But what we are trying to do is, as the new frontier in pest management, is rather than just having these pests pulse through every few years and eventually decline our populations through to extinction, is move from what's called pest suppression, which has been the predominant model in the New Zealand mainland, pest suppression where you just crush the numbers down to very low numbers and stop them exploding. We want to move towards something that we do on the offshore islands of New Zealand, which is called eradication. And there's this in-between ground called elimination, which is where you might not be able to find every last individual and eradicate them from the North or South Island today. But what you can do is eliminate them so that they're no longer able to find others to breed with. So they're at such low numbers that even when these mass seeding events come through, the animals aren't able to breed up because they just can't find each other. So this is really an interim step that we're applying at the moment as we work towards a predator-free New Zealand where we might actually be able to eradicate these predators from New Zealand. And there's parts of New Zealand already, particularly down in South Westland, so Franz Josef and Okarito townships and the surrounding forest and farmland where these rats have now and stoats have now been eliminated and they just can't find each other. There's still the odd one that comes through down the road or crosses over a stream or comes over the mountaintops, but it can't find anyone to breed with. So that's a really exciting frontier, which just gives us another tool to conserve our native species. Doc do great work translating that fundamental science into applied management outcomes. I think the real critical thing we're looking at is return on investment or bang for buck. So how much does it cost per year to suppress pests per hectare and having to commit to that in perpetuity versus how much can we pay to eliminate these rats from the landscape? So, for example, if we can eliminate rats from the landscape and then keep them out for $100 per hectare per year, that's pretty much a bargain basement price and something we could actually afford across the whole of the country.
With 1080, I know that there are some people out there who feel very strongly about it. How do you approach that issue?
Ultimately, we're doing this conservation, I like to think, first and foremost for the birds, but we're also doing it for people. It's people making decisions for the birds and enacting those on behalf of the birds. So the use of toxins that people have created is fundamentally a human-centered decision. So I really like to work with communities, and that's what we've seen through Franz Josef and Okarito. There's communities, there are people there that were resistant to poison use, but people have sat down with them, had a lot of cups of tea that ironically have 1080 in them at Trace levels, and said, look, if we move to elimination, we just get to use 1080 once, and then we don't have to come back and use it every 3 years or every 5 years with mass seeding events. If you just let us use it once and we pursue this elimination strategy, then in the long run, we can stop using toxin, which is better for the environment and better for animal welfare. So that's really what I'd like to move towards. But at the end of the day, it's just about having a conversation and making sure people are on side and that their concerns are addressed and they don't feel sidelined in the decision-making about pest management and conservation.
Right, so lots of consultation with the community. On the 1080 and the tea, what's going on there?
1080 is a naturally occurring substance. So what happened was it exists in tea and eucalypt, and I think I did a back of the envelope conversation once that if somebody managed to drink 200 cups of tea in a day, they might start to feel some impact of 1080. But if you've drunk 200 cups of tea, you're probably going to have other bodily function issues coming up first. But then scientists realized that it did have toxic effects at very high dosages. So that's what scientists did back in the day. They extracted the toxin and learned how to synthesize it in the laboratory so they could manufacture it. And then obviously everything is a toxin at high enough doses. We've all heard the joke about how if you have too much of that horrible chemical H2O, then you might keel over. But it's all about really just the dose response.
I then spoke with the coordinator of the Department of Conservation's, or DOCS, Predator Control Program, Peter Morton.
I'd love to get DOCS' perspective on everything. We heard it was a big challenge. In conservation terms, a pretty core and significant moment. What does the megamass mean for DOC?
It means that there's an exceptional level of risk for some of our most threatened wildlife because of the spike in predators that are coming on the back of the mast. So we're particularly worried about some of New Zealand's most threatened wildlife. Just a couple of examples are kea, the alpine parrot, mohua or yellowhead. There's rock wren that live up in the alpine zone, and a very rare parakeet, kakariki karaka or orange-fronted parakeet. All of these are only found in the South Island, and they're all going to be at higher risk from rats and then stoats as predators. So what we're doing is cranking up our predator control and response. We'll do a lot more work than usual in two phases. The first is happening now, where we're trying to push predator numbers down as low as possible before the beach seed is produced in the coming autumn. So between now and roughly February next year, we're really pushing hard on predators at a whole lot of sites across the South Island. We're going to have to stop then and wait until the beach seed is gone. We found it's ineffective to try and control predators while with a food glut. Once that beach seed's germinated or been eaten, we'll be back for the second phase with a whole lot of work at the beginning of 2027.
And is this mostly through ground trapping? Is this through aerial coverage? How do you suppress the populations?
We use everything we've got. Look, the scale of this is enormous. Ground control is useful, but we'll just be overwhelmed with the hundreds of thousands of hectares of conservation land that's at risk. So the biggest and best tool we've got is Aerial 1080, which has done a really good job in previous masts of stopping the impact from rats and stoats on these threatened wildlife populations.
And when you drop 1080, this is in a more physical form? This isn't sort of spraying, right? This is how does that look?
Ah, sure. 1080 is a biodegradable toxin, and a very small amount is mixed in with a small pellet, like a little cereal blob about the size of the end of your thumb. The pellet's dyed green, which deters birds, and it's got a cinnamon additive in it because that flavour also deters birds, but actually attracts other things like possums. We have very tightly controlled application of the bait from helicopters using GPS locating equipment to place a small number of baits in exactly the right places. We are applying about 4 to 6 baits in an area the size of a tennis court. So there's not a lot of baits hitting the ground in any given area, but we are covering a lot of ground. So we'll try and protect roughly 600,000 hectares of New Zealand's public forests using Aerial 1080 the coming summer.
And these areas are mostly based in the South Island. I'm sure there's quite a few of them, but could you give us some general examples?
Yeah, sure thing. So essentially, it's our most well-known national park. So Kahurangi up in the top of the South Island, New Zealand's biggest national park. Also Mount Aspiring National Park, Arthur's Pass, that's the only sort of naturally occurring population of orange-fronted parakeets is still found there, and also Fiordland National Park as well.
Professor James Russell talked about these mastings, especially one as big as this one, have the potential to be deeply threatening to our local species, to the potential of extinction. Do you buy that?
Oh, totally. Yeah, he's absolutely right. One of the reasons we've learnt about mast and are responding so forcefully is because of the experience that occurred in Mount Stokes, for example, in the Marlborough Sound, where the local population of mohua or yellowhead were wiped out because of the intense predation pressure that occurs when these masts happen. So we've learnt the hard way that if you don't stop predators during a mast, you definitely can actually see populations of threatened species wiped out completely.
And with all these resources that DOC is committing to this, how much of a drain on DOC's resources is controlling this masting going to have?
Well, it's what we're here for. So this is a real important piece of work from a conservation point of view. We've done this before. We've learned through successive masts that have occurred over the years how to do this. It's a big job. Pest control contractors, they're going to be flat out over the next few months. We can do this. We're resourced to make a decent effort.
And as we wrap up, if our listeners have any way that they want to help out with masting or just conservation in general, what sort of ways might they be able to?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and is a very valuable contribution being made by the members of the community. The best move is to connect with one of your local predator control groups. There are groups all over the country. I'm just going to mention a couple that are relevant to the beach mast. So, for example, the Southern Lakes Sanctuary Trust does a lot of really good work in Makarora and Matukituki and, Mount Aspiring National Park, and Friends of Flora, who for decades have been helping look after a chunk of Kaharangi National Park. If people want to help plug into a local community group, a good way to find them is through the Predator Free 2050 website, which coordinates community effort towards predator control.
Finally, is there anything you want to share with our listeners before we end things?
It's a fantastic natural phenomenon that occurs in our beach forest. So beach masts aren't a bad thing, but they do have a sting in their tail with the predators that also spike whenever a mast occurs. But we've learned through really good science and monitoring and research to predict them, what's happening, how to deal with them, and how to at least take the edge off the biggest impact in terms of the risk to our threatened wildlife.
That was Peter Morton, the coordinator of the Department of Conservation's Predator Control Program, and before that, James Russell, Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, discussing the upcoming mass fruiting of beech trees, which is expected to cause an explosion in predator populations, and the conservation efforts aimed at controlling it.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Koira te ho takakato mo tene wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korido mai ki au mo tene ra. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, the University of Auckland's Lisa Darrah and James Russell, and the Department of Conservation's Peter Morton. Nada hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the bee.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.